You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of April 16th, 2018. On this week's show, Daryl Morey, the general manager of the NBA's best team, the Houston Rockets, will join us to talk about his new basketball musical, Small Ball. ESPN's Bill Barnwell will also be here to explain why NFL teams are so bad at evaluating quarterbacks. And Mike Schur, the creator of Parks and Rec and The Good Place, will explain his infatuation with Dan Le Batard, the host of a sports radio show that is only very occasionally about sports. Joining me here at the Slate office in Washington, D.C., mere blocks away from three other offices that used to be Slate's Washington, D.C. office, it's Stefan Fatsis, author of a Twitter thread that inspired the OED to add the word slimeball to the dictionary. Hello, Stefan.
Well, they're working on it. They claim they were working on it before Trump used slimeball in a tweet. And then
well, what would you expect them to say?
Well, you know, I mean, it's in their online free dictionary.
Yeah, that doesn't count.
No, doesn't count.
Congratulations for inspiring the OED to add slimeball to the dictionary.
Thanks, Josh.
I'm sticking to it.
Shocking that it wasn't in there already.
I'm going to read a little. It's very shocking. I'm going to read a little intro to our Daryl Morey conversation in a second. I just want to say before we get into it that we had eight first-round NBA playoff games this weekend. We'll have ample time to discuss LeBron's impending departure from Cleveland, the Pacers sweep. But we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We want to let the playoffs play out mm-hmm. a little bit more before we get too deep. So with that being said, on Sunday night in Houston, the top-seeded Rockets held off the Minnesota Timberwolves 104-101 in game one of their first round Western Conference playoff series with the help of 44 points from the likely NBA MVP, James Harden. Joining us now, a leading candidate for the NBA's Executive of the Year, Rockets General Manager, Daryl Morey. Welcome to the show, Daryl.
Hey, Josh, Stefan, thanks for having me.
So I didn't say that you are the likely winner for the NBA's Executive of the Year because I don't want to disrespect the other top executives in the NBA, but you're having a very, very good year, Daryl. And I'm wondering how you, as somebody who has a very analytical mind, how do you consume the playoffs? Because like game one of the series that you watched last night, I wouldn't have anticipated that like Derrick Rose was going to be the leading scorer for the Wolves for most of the game. Like everything that happened in that game is, you know, you're not going to anticipate. And as we saw all weekend, like these series got off to unexpected starts. Like, as an executive, do you just kind of sit back and watch and, you know, enjoy or not enjoy? Or do you like look for trends and patterns in the games?
The main thing we're trying to do is always look for what's, what are things that are going to repeat and that we can have an influence on, and what things are just random that, can mislead your decision making. So, yeah, I think both coaches and everyone in the organization and appreciate the kind words on our season. But as you know, like any of those of the year awards are really organization awards. We're not looking for the one-offs, the things that probably won't happen again, the missed free throws. That we're looking for systematic ways they're guarding us, we're guarding them, that we'll repeat that we can maybe influence to help us going forward.
All right. Enough basketball, Daryl. You're obviously hoping that the Rockets make beautiful music in these playoffs, but here's my terrible segue. We invited you here to talk about actual music, more specifically your role as a producer of a musical that opened in Houston earlier this month. It's called Small Ball. Let's listen to a clip from the song Sex with Giants.
Wanna get naked with giants, or know what's between 4 and 6, how to bring the
not grasp the mechanics.
Oh, God.
Do we want to have sex with giants?
Sex with giants.
Sex with giants.
Sex with giants.
Sex with giants.
All right, to clarify, this is not a musical about NBA groupies. These are actual giants, right, Daryl? Maybe you should tell us a little bit about Small Ball and what this musical is about.
It's basically, you know, there's an undiscovered country that was recently discovered that wants to join the world stage. And so to do that, they start an international FIBA basketball team because they think that's the best way to get themselves on the map. So they hire Michael Jordan from the United States to come to their island to help with their team. And then when he gets there, they find out to their dismay, they've hired not the Michael Jordan, just some other guy named Michael Jordan, who's actually a washed up player. And then you also find out that it's the island of Lilliput has been rediscovered. And not Michael Jordan has joined a bunch of 6-inch tall teammates to try and win basketball games. And so hijinks and a love story ensue. So that's the elevator pitch, I guess.
We've got a lot of follow-up questions for you, Daryl. I think the natural place to start is with your love of musical theater. Like, this is something that's been a passion of yours since you were really young, right?
Yeah, very, very young. I always like thematic music. I just didn't know it. I loved Pink Floyd, The Wall. I loved Meatloaf, Bat Out of Hell, to come up with a ridiculous Tommy, The Who.
To date yourself,
Tommy.
And, yeah.
Yeah, I date myself a little bit. Oh, my dad was big into music. He was not into musicals, though, so I always loved those kinds of albums. And then when I was in middle school, we played I was in the band. Every nerd stereotype applies to me. So I was in the band. And
what'd you play?
I played trombone, euphonium, tuba, trumpet, all the mouthpiece instruments. And so primarily trombone, though, but basically, we played Les Mis, and I thought it was amazing. And so from there, it just sparked. Miss Saigon came out. I learned about Andrew Lloyd Webber, and then I learned about the real drug of musical theater, Sondheim. And then forevermore, I was done. I was hooked on the Sondheim heroin.
So, were you like singing musicals in the car? Were you? Did you go to Broadway and go to 6 musicals in a weekend? How did you feed your...
Well, so I didn't even fly on a plane until I was 19. No, 20, actually. So I did not get to New York. I'm from rural Ohio. I was born in Wisconsin. So I was, like, trying to grab cassette tapes and then CDs by the end of musicals, wherever I could find them at the local music store, which no one listening under the age of 30 will know what I'm talking about. But there used to be these places where you would buy cassette tapes in malls. The Summit Mall in near Akron, Ohio was my mall.
So the genesis of this particular project was that you were doing an online Q&A when you were traveling around Europe, and you mentioned in that Q&A that you were into musicals, and then this answer got on the Rockets message board, clutchfans.net. It's like the greatest moment in the history of online team-affiliated message boards, the birth of the musical Small Ball. And so what was the process from this being just like an idea that was like circulating among Rockets fans on the internet that like our general manager loves musicals to this actually becoming a show that's on stage in Houston right
now? I just want to interrupt and say that the artistic director of a theater in Houston was one of the regulars on this message board and saw your response.
I didn't think there was really any overlap between, basketball and musical theater. And I think that's still largely true, to be frank. But I did find through this Q&A, there's a theater, Catastrophic Theater, where we've done this play, that the whole place is full of Rockets fans. It's amazing. I mean, to the extent that when the Rockets were in the finals, they've been around for 25 years. When the Rockets were in the finals in 95, I believe, they held up their the second half of their show for the end of the Rockets game, and the whole crowd watched the game. They had a play where they made the ultimate evil person Hitler, Saddam Hussein, and the Utah Jazz. So, I mean, it just gives you a sense. These guys are passionate fans. So I had an immediate connection.
Tell us a little more about the plot. The Lilliputians don't use the number five, so that's a problem, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do they play? Tell us what happens in small ball. Without giving away too much, because we're expecting it to come to other cities soon.
Yeah, I think, we're definitely planning on another run in another city.
Yeah.
I don't know which one. We have a general plan, but I don't want to say it because then it might, if we don't go there, people wonder why. But I think it's going to come to another major city next year. But you ask, how does it work? Well, that's a big part of the show. That part I probably can't reveal. I can just tell you that it worked.
Your passion for musical theater, you're also really into table tennis. It leads me to wonder if you have an appreciation for players when you're looking for, folks for the Rockets who have interests outside the sport. Because, there's all this conversation around, Josh Rosen, we're going to get to in a minute in another segment, around, does he really love football? Does he care about other stuff too much? Based on the fact that, during the playoffs, you're, talking about musical theater, do you have more of an appreciation for the fact that people can have lives and interests outside of the sport that they're playing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with my job, I really only care about wins. So I just, not to disappoint you with my answer, but I don't care much that they have outside interest. But what I would say is that I have found that players that are more well-rounded actually are better players, if that makes sense at all.
Yeah, so, right. So if you found that the players with outside interests were worse players, you would say you shouldn't have outside interests.
That's correct. I think Coach Popovich has addressed this a bunch of times, that he's found that players with outside interests and understand more of the world, he thinks they're better on the floor, and it's pretty hard to argue with Coach Popovich, given he has the best record in the league since he's been here. We're second best, but they've got us by a good margin, sadly, and bunch of rings.
Have any of the players been to the musical yet?
Yeah, it was great. I didn't want to invite anyone from the Rockets org because I didn't want that dynamic of the boss is doing
this see it.
Terrible thing and I got to go. But I was tickled. Yeah, four of the players ended up coming when they heard about it. Chris Paul, Trevor, PJ, and Ryan, and all seemed to enjoy it, but you'd have to ask them. So
when they said that they enjoyed it, what was the tone of their voice? Was it like, that was really good? Or was it like, that was amazing?
I think a little closer to the first. I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, you want to hear what you want to hear sometimes. So I think a lot of the jokes land if you know basketball, even though you don't really need to be a basketball fan to get it. So I think they enjoyed a lot of that. There's after one of the losses, the head coach comes in and talks about how, I always picture Coach Van Gundy, who I worked with, and how, miserable he was after press conferences. And so the coach of the team comes in disheveled and tired and talks about the only thing that allows him to know he still exists is the pain he's feeling from the loss. So the song is Pain. Pain is all that, all there is that tells me I'm still here. That's the name of the song.
Daryl, did you contribute in any way? Did you go over the script? Did you tweak anything to make it more basketball-y?
So they gave me a fake title. I thought it was completely fake just to make me feel cool throughout the process. Dramaturg. I had never heard that before. So I think it's like when we give a really fancy title to an intern, so they feel like they're more involved. So, I want to be careful here. I mean, this is really, the genius of the Mikkel and Anthony and Merrill. I spoke to them, Mikkel in particular. We would have basically calls every week or two, and he came down and, you know, went to a bunch of our press conferences and things like that. So I like to feel like I had some input. I think I did, but I don't want to, like, I really want people to understand how it was these other folks who really were the driving force behind the creativity of it.
You mentioned wanting to take small ball to other cities. Has the process of working on this show made you want to develop other musicals, or what is next for you in terms of the world of musical theater?
You know, and actually I already am in process working on a couple other things in my late nights. So, I have a lot of fun with it. So hopefully we'll continue to do something like this.
So the kind of lame version to ask this last question would be, would you rather a Tony Award or an NBA title?
Yeah.
But I think the better version is, would you rather a Tony Award or would you rather have Andrew Tony in his prime on your team?
That's a great, I think prime Andrew Tony. Yeah, I'm pretty focused on the NBA title. That's what I've been working for 17 years on in the NBA. So I'm way, way more focused on that. I also like, you know, I'm a pretty foundational truth guy, and I like that basketball games have a score at the end, and you know who won and you know who lost. You know, the subjective world of the arts sometimes drives me nuts. I was happy we got good reviews, but I would have been pretty proud of this show either way and what was accomplished. So I'm pretty partial to the NBA championship by a big margin. So I'll take Andrew Tony. He could help us, yeah.
You just better hope that James Harden doesn't see the show and decide that he's going to transition to musical theater next year.
He's not. James knows I'm weird already, and you know, I think we've had a good relationship because he knows, like, all I do is try and figure out how to help him win and take his input. And he's sort of an out of the box thinker as well. So I think that helps us get along.
Now, he might go the Michael Jordan route though, you know, give up basketball for musical theater.
That would really disappoint me. I think James is really going to do a lot in his career. First, hopefully win multiple titles, but I mean, I found that the superstar players, they're extremely smart, and James being number one on that list, like, and I think it's just, you know, being smart helps in every venue, and, you know, he knows what work it's going to take. He knows, you know, and I think he famously understands, you know, where are the edges of the game where he can gain an advantage wherever he can.
Daryl Morey is the general manager of the Houston Rockets. He's also the dramaturg of the musical Small Ball, which you can see at the Catastrophic Theater in Houston and hopefully at a city near you soon. Daryl, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Before we talk to Bill Barnwell about NFL quarterbacks, I wanted to let you know that we will have a very special bonus segment today. We're going to talk to Mike Schur in our third segment about the Dan Le Batard Show. He's going to stick around for the bonus, and we're going to have a really good conversation. We already had this conversation, so I can tease it.
It did sound like you were predicting we would have a good conversation,
No,
Josh.
It was really good. We taped it already.
We could have predicted it anyway, though.
It was about Bartolo Colon and about the name of the year. It's very funny. Mike Schur is a very funny dude. If you want to hear that conversation, join Slate Plus for just $35 a year. You can get a free trial. I would recommend signing up to hear this. It's good stuff from the Good Place guy, Mike Schur. You can sign up at slate.com/hangoutplus.
The NFL draft later this month is shaping up as a quarterback bonanza. Draft mavens expect 5 signal callers to be selected in the first round. That would tie 1999 for the second most field generals taken in round one. 6 were chosen in 1983. Let's remember some of those 11 guys because they were, of course, all awesome. Cade McNown, Akili Smith, Tony Eason, Todd Blackledge, Ken O'Brien, Dante Culpepper, Tim Couch. Also John Elway, Jim Kelly, Dan Marino, and Donovan McNabb. But that's the point. The NFL has been historically poor at evaluating incoming quarterbacks. And today, despite a glut of information, that ability may be even worse than ever. ESPN's Bill Barnwell wrote about this phenomenon earlier this month. Hey, Bill.
Hey, guys.
Thanks for joining us. So much attention is paid, of course, to the Tim Couches and Akili Smiths and Ryan Leafs and Johnny Manziels. Every quarterback pick is so prominent. It's become popular wisdom that the NFL generally sucks at projecting quarterbacks. How bad is the NFL really at this job?
Well, I think in the broader sense, they're okay. And I guess we don't know because we don't see every 5th and 6th and 7th round pick get an opportunity to play quarterback. But I do think in general, if they have grades on guys as first round picks, they're going to be better than the guys who are 6th and 7th round picks. I do think that's the case. However, when it comes to sorting between those different tiers, when it comes to picking guys within the first round, for example, I have no faith in their ability, and they have exhibited no ability to pick, say, the best guy first or the second best guy second. In terms of those tiers, it pretty much is just a random ball. And I went back and looked at the last, I think, 19, 20 drafts, and I think they chose the best quarterback first among those drafts 5 times, which is not promising. You should be able to tell the difference between, you know, Andrew Luck and a guy who's not going to be playing in the league for very long. And in that case, Andrew Luck is okay, but Russell Wilson, who was a third-round pick who every team passed on at least once, who the Jaguars famously drafted a punter ahead of and said that they preferred a punter because they'd rather have a starter than a backup, in the case of Russell Wilson, was the quote to the AP at the time. I think you can make the case that Russell Wilson is a better quarterback or a more productive quarterback than Andrew Luck's been over the course of his career.
This is the most fascinating question in sports to me in some ways, because there's so many incentives, as you lay out in your 2-part series on this, Bill, to get this question right. You know, you say it's hundreds of millions of dollars it's worth to a franchise to get the franchise quarterback right. I mean, in the Saints, you know, the team that I root for, you could argue that if they hadn't signed Drew Brees in free agency, the franchise might not even be in New Orleans anymore. And so it can be existential to a franchise. And so if you combine the just insane incentive to get this right with the fact that there's so much knowledge and so much tape now, it's remarkable to me that teams aren't better at this. And so do you feel like, if you were looking at this in a vacuum and you didn't know how well teams did at picking quarterbacks, would you think that they would have improved over time?
I guess the thing I wonder is this, and I don't know what you guys think about this, but the guy that made me really think about writing this column to begin with was Jared Goff, who was a quarterback who was drafted with the first overall pick, had not been someone who throughout his college career had been, you know, projected to be the first overall pick. It kind of just happened over the course of the evaluation process. And year one, Jared Goff was the worst quarterback in football. He came into the final second half of the year. He was terrible. Year two, we saw what happened. Get the right coach, bring in a couple of receivers, you improve the offensive line. Jared Goff looked like a Pro Bowl quarterback. So when it comes to that idea of whether teams are bad at this, I really wonder whether it's just that they're bad at picking quarterbacks or they're bad at developing an infrastructure where quarterbacks can succeed.
Or are they just bad at this because it appears that they're bad at this because the variables are so great and it's hard to project how athletes are going to perform. As you point out in your piece, there's a wider range of passing offenses in colleges. You have obstinate coaches in the NFL who have a difficult time finding ways to translate amateur success into the pro sets of the NFL. Quarterbacks are getting smarter and their agents are gaming the combine and draft process. They know what teams are looking for. They become more selective about how much they want to show teams. And the expectations are ridiculous. It is a huge, important pick because you're getting potentially the most important player on your team at a terrific financial value for the course of his rookie contract. So the expectations are overwhelming. I mean, what GM this year is willing to say, yeah, we're going to take Sam Darnold, but we really don't have a clue about whether he's going to be great, good, mediocre, or a total bust in the NFL. And before you respond to any of that, I just want to say that Brian Anger has had a very good career as a punter.
He was okay for the Jags. He left, and he's been much better, I believe, in Tampa.
Yes.
He's been a totally fine punter. No one is criticizing Brian Anger in the kind. I hope not. I'm not criticizing Brian Anger.
Well, also before you pipe up, Bill, the quarterback that has led me to think about these questions is Kurt Warner, because there is a plausible scenario in which one of the greatest quarterbacks in NFL history never even gets to play in the NFL. Like, the fact that he made it was like a crazy story, that he was like a stocker in a grocery store and he was playing in the Arena League and finally he gets a chance. Like, I have a really hard time imagining a scenario in which one of the all-time greatest NBA players just like never even sniffs the NBA or barely even gets an opportunity. I'm sure people can like point to, you know, Dennis Rodman or something. Maybe that's a counterexample. But it feels like more common in football that, you know, a guy at quarterback who turns out to be really good is thought to be really bad or doesn't even get an opportunity.
I mean, look at Case Keenan last year, where very successful college quarterback comes into the league, gets a bunch of reps. It's not just a guy like Kurt Warner, where he's even not even in the league. I mean, or, you know, sort of on the outskirts of the league, not getting an opportunity. He's mediocre in a bunch of places. And then suddenly, right context, right offense, stays healthy, good offensive line, he suddenly has a career season in Minnesota. So it's even, you can even have guys who have 1,000 NFL pass attempts who look like a totally different quarterback and who have been totally underestimated over the course of their career. And it is sort of humbling to think about, you know, somebody like Tom Brady, where if, let's say, Drew Bledsoe doesn't get hurt, Tom Brady gets cut the next year, maybe he bounces around the league for a year or two, and he's out of football. And Tom Brady's the most important athlete in the NFL of the last 25 years. It's sort of scary. And it's sort of scary to think that even when you get past the draft, even when you get past the idea of you know, we're going to scout these guys in college, we don't know what they're going to be in the pros, even once you have these guys, you know, in your building, when you have them at practice, I don't know that teams are necessarily great at sorting between them and picking the right guy.
Well, maybe 20% is not a bad success rate. I mean, maybe what we need to rethink is how we evaluate success in terms of analyzing and drafting and developing NFL players. I mean, as you point out, analytics really haven't helped that much yet. There's not a tremendous correlation between college performance and future NFL performance. Teams go through all this bullshit about, you know, trying to assess player personalities, and they think they have some sort of secret, great psychological understanding of about how these 22-year-old guys are going to turn out to be as leaders and players. And teams want to believe that they're making informed decisions. And maybe the reality is it's hard to make informed decisions.
I don't buy that at all.
Really?
I feel like 20%, I mean, Bill might be better able than either of us to give a percentage of like what the hit rate or success rate is, but that just seems way too low. Like, it seems like there's enough information out there and we should have learned enough by this point to do way better than they're doing. I mean, maybe the fact that they're not doing better is like more is evidence on your side rather than mine.
Yeah.
But I just feel like I feel comfortable sitting here and saying they're doing a bad job and it feels like they should be doing better.
Well, Kevin Clark wrote a piece for The Ringer, Bill, that I'm sure you read, that mm-hmm. basically posits that we still don't know what to do with this information. These are all amazing athletes and were all great quarterbacks in college at different levels of play and different statistical accomplishments, but they were all really good.
Mm-hmm. Now, having said all that, if you believe that the rate is 20%, I think it's my guess. If I had to pick a number, we don't have a ton of data because there's only so many first round quarterbacks we can work with. But in terms of first round picks, I think it's about 40% wind up working out into something pretty useful where I think the team doesn't regret the guy they chose. But let's say 40%. That's not a good number. That's not a good percentage. You're not pleased given how much money you're investing. So
right. I'm not saying that it's a good percentage. I'm just saying mm-hmm. that maybe that's the best that NFL right. organizations are able to do, right. maybe within the bounds of variance and statistical windows. That's about as good as you're going to get.
Right. But now let's say that's the case, and you're an organization that wants to be smart. You say, well, we're not good at picking quarterbacks. No one's going to pick a quarterback. So what we're going to do is not take that quarterback in the top five. We're going to trade down. We're going to grab a bunch of picks. We're going to take a shot at a bunch of quarterbacks and hope that we stumble on the right guy. That makes sense. You've also just described the last 2 years of the Cleveland Browns, and you've just been fired from your job if you're Sashi Brown. So that's logical, but I think there's also that element of I don't know that you can necessarily run a team that way because you're just not going to get the time frame you need to succeed. And I think at some point, even a smart team like the Eagles, who have Howie Roseman, they are an organization steeped in analytics. They're very comfortable using numbers. They're very smart. A lot of decisions they make are based in a very sound reasoning, not always perfect, but at least there's a logic behind a lot of the things they do that's pretty clear. They had to trade up and take a shot at Carson Wentz because you may only have one shot to get a guy before you get replaced as general manager and head coach. So I don't know that it's going to get better in part just because we fire coaches quicker than we did before, or we change quicker than we did before, maybe 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Let's talk specifically about the guys at the top of this year's draft, which it's really a great like buffet because you have all different
yes.
types of first round quarterback. You have Sam Darnold, who I would describe as the guy, like the has all the tools guy. Like you look at yeah. him and he's like, he can make all the throws. He's agile in the pocket, great athlete. Maybe not, you know, some issues with interceptions, but he's got all the tools. Then mm-hmm. you've got Josh Rosen. Maybe he's got an attitude problem. what do we think of his attitude?
He thinks too much.
Then you've got Lamar Jackson, who had the unbelievable numbers, but let's switch him to wide receiver. Baker.
So he has a skin color problem, according to some NFL front office.
He seems to. Then you've got Baker Mayfield, who has unbelievable stats, but maybe he's a little too short. And then you've got Josh Allen.
Also attitude, Baker Mayfield. Cocky.
Cocky.
He's arrogant. He's cocky.
And then you have Josh Allen, the small school guy with the amazing arm, but like the really bad completion percentage. And maybe he'll be a bust, or maybe he'll like turn out to be
Carson Wentz.
So all that stuff that I just said, Bill, you'll have anonymous scouts, or you'll have people put their name to it who just have such confident pronouncements about, you know, what these guys are going to turn out to be.
Mm-hmm.
This, despite all of the decades of data you've described, where people have no idea what they're talking about. When are we going to get the anonymous scouts being like, here's my, anonymously, I have no fucking idea what is going to happen. And anybody who says they do is a liar.
Well, I'll tell you, if I ever go work in the NFL, and I have no plans to do so, but who knows, maybe one day I will, and you see a quote from an anonymous scout or an anonymous executive saying exactly that, I promise you, that's me, because I'm the only person who will be thinking that way. I mean, if you're a general manager, and it's a little higher up than a scout, but let's say a general manager, and I brought this up before, you start as a scout making 20 grand a year, or as a coffee guy in the office making 20 grand a year, you become a position scout, you're a local scout, you move around, you have a job where you're making nothing for a long time, and eventually, out of hundreds of scouts, hundreds of guys in the same tier, you rise through the ranks and eventually become a general manager. You have an irrational confidence at some point. You think, okay, well, what I succeeded where dozens or hundreds of people like me did not. So I think you naturally have a sort of unwarranted faith in your opinion and your ability to you know, project guys to succeed, even if necessarily you don't. You just happen to be the guy who sort of benefited from the Wyatt Earp effect. Someone had to break through, and so you did. I think that's the right attitude to have, is that I don't know any better, but I don't think anyone's going to go into a job interview as a general manager and say, well, you know, I don't really know who's any good. I just think we're going to guess, and I don't think anyone else is any good, so we're going to try and trade for extra picks, and we're going to take the guy who falls and just surround him with the right talent and hope that he works out, because owners don't want to hear that. Owners want to hear, I can look into a guy's eyes in 3 seconds and know if he's going to be an NFL quarterback. And that's the kind of scout, and that's the kind of quote, and that's the kind of guy who gets promoted in the NFL.
So rationally, Bill, analytically, if there were some statistic, and you cited a bunch of things that you, mm-hmm. numbers that you looked at in your pieces, what data that front offices have access to, mm-hmm. do you think best reflects who might succeed?
Well, it seems like accuracy is the thing that translates well. If you don't have it in college, there are exceptions, I would say. There have been guys who have changed scheme and maybe been a little better. Matthew Stafford, perhaps, is an example where he was not a very accurate passer in college and had a huge arm, but plays in a scheme where he throws a lot of short passes in Detroit, and his numbers look a lot better. But usually it's the guys who don't have accuracy who seem to fail in the NFL. And usually it's guys who don't have accuracy who have strong arms. And, well, I think the obvious candidate there is Josh Allen. And maybe that's not fair. I mean, there are arguments that Josh Allen is an underrated quarterback in some ways, didn't have a ton of talent around him. And I think that's a fair argument to make. I don't know that anyone else makes it for any other quarterback. I don't think if there's a quarterback who was super accurate, who had a very weak arm, that I would hear the same scouts making the same arguments about him not having talent around him. But I do think that archetype tends to fail more than any other one. Now, I don't think that means Josh Allen is necessarily going to fail, but I do think he's a higher risk option perhaps than some of the other quarterbacks in this year's draft.
I would, my last thought here is that I feel like as observers of the sport and people who don't watch film, I haven't seen Josh Allen play. I feel like we still end up rooting for guys who will like confirm our beliefs. Like, mm-hmm. I want Lamar Jackson to succeed at quarterback because I think it's like, it's racist that he doesn't get an opportunity. I also would like Josh Rosen to succeed at quarterback because I feel like people are saying maybe he's too smart for his own good or have an attitude problem. I would like those people to look stupid, and I would like Josh Rosen to, you know, prove that you can be a reasonably thoughtful human being and be a good NFL quarterback. So I feel like I just want to own up to the fact that I have biases and that I am rooting for these guys. And I would like kind of, I mean, I have nothing against Josh Allen, but just the notion that the guy with like the big arm with the low completion percentage is going to be the number one pick seems like silly to me. But I have like no idea. Like, he could be the greatest quarterback ever, and Lamar Jackson could be a total bust. So I just want to put it out there that I know absolutely nothing. Don't trust what I say.
Can I also put that out there? I cover this sport for a living, and I would not pretend for a second that I know which one of these guys is going to succeed. Of course I have, like you said, my biases as well. I want Baker Mayfield to succeed because I think he plays in an exciting scheme. I think he's a super accurate quarterback. When I look at the numbers, he's head and shoulders above everybody else. And I like that. That seems easy and logical to me. It makes sense in my brain that the guy who is better at football in college would be better at football in the pros than guys who were not as good in college. That seems like it's totally reasonable. And that would make life so much simpler for me to just be able to say, okay, well, this guy was good then. He's going to be good now. But I don't know that the evidence supports that's likely to be the case.
Bill Barnwell is a staff writer for ESPN. Go read his story. History tells us the NFL is terrible at evaluating quarterbacks. Here's what it means for 2018. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thanks, guys.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
For our last topic of the day, we're going to welcome in Mike Schur, the creator of Parks and Rec and The Good Place and many other fine television products. He wrote a piece that we published on Slate last week. It was headlined, "Do You Get the Show? ESPN's Dan Le Batard Built a Sports Talk Empire by Talking About Sports as Little as Possible." Mike Schur, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's very exciting to be here.
I want to give the listeners a little bit of insight into the Slate editorial process. I sent an email last week to our staff explaining this was our cover story. I was, you know, so happy to have it. Here's what the gist of the story is. And my colleague Dan Kois responded and saying, this piece is really delightful and I can't recommend it enough. Josh, how did you get Mike to do it? And I wrote back, he asked me if he could write it and I said, okay. And then,
yeah, that checks out. Yeah.
And then Dan wrote back, this email is yet another example, if we even needed one, of Josh Levine's prodigious storytelling talents. So enough about me. Let's give the people a little bit of a richer backstory here. It is true that you asked me if you could write the story and I said, okay, but what got you interested in Dan Le Batard as a subject, and what got you interested in his show?
I knew Le Batard. I've known him for a long time, not personally, but I've loved his work. And I thought that, and this is sort of unique to media personalities, I had this feeling about him that every time I saw him talk about something, it was interesting. You know, he sort of made his name years and years ago, because he was a columnist for the Miami Herald who occasionally did stuff on ESPN, and he came out and said that he believed that Steve Nash had beaten Shaq for the NBA MVP in part because of racism. And I just remember seeing him say that and thinking, boy, that is not the kind of take. That's not the kind of opinion you hear people like willing to express openly, outwardly on television. And I sort of followed his career. You know, that was whatever, 2003 or something. And I just sort of followed him. He would pop up on PTI from time to time. He would do stuff here and there. I always found him interesting and worth listening to, but about a year and a half ago, I started listening to his show. And it was one of those things where it very quickly became a sort of daily routine for me. It's one of those things where I started to feel like if I didn't listen to it on a certain day, that I had missed something. And I just clicked for some reason with the absurdities of it, with the inside jokes, the routines they had, the sort of whole vibe of it. I just became really enamored of it. And so after like a year and a half of listening to this thing every day, I emailed you and said, I need to write about this or I got to get it out of my head. I have to write about this so I can figure out how it's done and how they're doing it. And the process of going down there to Miami and talking to them, the people who make the show, the people who work on it, it sort of confirmed for me exactly what I had suspected, which is it's just this little unit of people who all deeply understand what they're doing and they're all on the same page and no one is telling them they can't do it. It's really kind of a vote ultimately. It's a vote for creative freedom.
I want to ask you to describe for people that don't listen to Le Batard what the show is about and what it is like. Because to me, what it feels like is Dan Le Batard is a very smart guy who, when he was a columnist for The Herald, wrote interesting columns. He wrote about social issues. He didn't just write about athletes. He was, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, young, smart, hip, willing to go beyond the boundaries that a lot of newspaper columnists establish for themselves. And what his radio show feels like is this, it hits this sweet spot between, you know, morning zoo and irreverent, smart conversations about topics you wouldn't normally think about as being completely sports.
Yeah, I think that's right. He is uniquely uninterested in sports talk radio qua sports talk radio. He does not ever want to say, you know, can Villanova repeat as national champions or, you know, what can we glean from the Astros' hot start or anything like that, like the kind of topics you expect to hear. The kind of process of sports radio that he really despises and all of the people who work with him despise is the hot take world, right? I'll tell you what, the Dodgers are 5-9, and you heard it here first, they're not going to make the playoffs. now you call in and scream at me and we'll scream at each other for 20 minutes and then we'll go to commercial. Like, he is either interested in goofing around with his friends at a level at which it's almost hard to overstate how little he cares about whether people like tune out because of his goofing around. Like, they just do what they want to do. And they have this in complete sort of like, they're almost talking in code. The inside jokes are so thick on that show. He either wants to be doing that or he wants to be saying, let's push the boundaries of what we're allowed to talk about. Among the many tensions on the show, which I find delightful, one of them is he's always talking about how far do you think we can push this envelope before we get fired? And all the younger people who work with him are always like, no, maybe don't do that. Maybe like, maybe we like our jobs. Don't get us all canned. And it's really two extremes. It's either extremely kind of in-depth political social examination, or it's utter frivolity, where if you haven't listened to the show for a year, you probably have no idea what's even going on.
Well, what you just described is part of the secret handshake aspect of the show, right? It's not just the thickness of the inside jokes. It's also the feeling that you're getting away with something, in a sense, by listening, that you're like being implicated in a good way, that like you're part of this club, that you're all getting away with something. It's not just the people on the show, it's the audience too. It's like, I can't believe this thing exists for me to listen to.
That's right. And there are, and for people who have that sort of approach to it and take that sort of pleasure from it, there are daily things that you can enjoy, that you hope for, you sense them coming, and you start to enjoy them. And then when they happen, it feels like your victory. So Greg Cody of the Miami Herald is a sort of old-timey reporter. I didn't talk to him for the piece, but he's a sort of old-timey Herald columnist who's a longtime friend of Lebatard's, and he comes on the show every Tuesday. And they have this thing with him where at the end of every hour, they have a hard network out where they have to cut really hard to a commercial. There's no, like, they wrap up a segment and then they do a little live ad and blah, 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 blah. It's just a hard cut. And this game started months and months and months ago, maybe years ago, where they try to get Cody talking so that they can cut him off in the middle of a sentence at the hard network app. And they do it, and he never learns. Like, part of the fun is that he never is aware enough of what's going on to know that it's coming. And when he's on, everyone who's a fan of the show is like, all right, let's see. And they'll release statistics, like, on their Twitter feed. They'll release statistics of, like, this year there have been, you know, whatever it is, 72 hard network outs. We've gotten them on 48 of them. That's this percentage, you know, like. And so it's like it is like a daily kind of absurdist game that you play along with. And I have to say that when they get him on the network out, it's always funny.
I think we've gone long enough in this segment without hearing an excerpt of the Dan Lebatard show. As an extremely unprofessional operation, I feel like maybe a professional operation would have played a clip by now. But let's play a little bit of an excerpt from the show back in March when Mike went to visit the studio.
Everything stops right now with the story Stu Gotz has on his computer. It is a magically 2018 basketball story. It's just one sentence of reporting, and I do believe that we can carry it for at least a week of shows. Listen to this 1 second of journalistic excellence by, is it Windhorst?
Yeah, sources tell Brian Windhorst that J.R. Smith was suspended Thursday for throwing a bowl of soup at assistant coach Damon Jones.
Read that again, please.
Sources tell Brian Windhorst that J.R. Smith was suspended Thursday for throwing a bowl of soup at assistant coach Damon Jones.
Mike, can you call Windhorst, please? Because I need to know what kind of soup it was. I've got so many follow-up questions. I want this to be the scandal of our lifetime.
What's delightful about that is that it is a piece of absurdist theater, right? Find the most ridiculous detail in a story that the rest of the sports world is treating super seriously. Conflict on a team. Somebody threw something at someone else, and you just take it and run with it. And you talked earlier, Mike, about this idea, and Josh, you too, about this notion that why this succeeds is because the audience feels like they're part of the act, that they get the joke. And that's any great TV show or radio show, isn't it, Mike? I mean, the people who you've entertained with your television shows feel like they understand the characters, that they're in on the joke. And that's what happens with Levitard.
Yes, it is like any TV show or any good kind of piece of entertainment. I will say that the thing that makes this unique in my mind is that this is the first, they're sort of the first people to do it like this. And, you know, in 1975, my first job was at SNL. And in 1975, when SNL burst onto the scene, they started doing commercial parodies. And people lost their minds because they had been watching commercials, straightforward, has this ever happened to you kind of commercials, for decades. And then someone came along and was like, what if we make fun of that? And then, like, you know, for 43 years, SNL's stock and trade has been commercial parodies. They're still doing them 43 years later. And, you know, when I talked to Eric Rideholm, who's an executive producer of a lot of different pieces of content in ESPN, including Pardon the Interruption, Around the Horn, and Highly Questionable, which is Levitard's TV show, he really summarized this well, I thought. He said that when he started PTI, there was no show that just talked about the basic daily sports issues of the day, that just did a rundown. Here's what happened today. Here's what we think about it. And so we started that, and they did it for 10 years. For 10 years, suddenly we had a bunch of shows where people just sort of talked about what happened in sports that day. Not in a sports center way, not in a highlight clip show kind of a way, but just in a, here are two people discussing these issues. So they did that for a decade. And then Levitard, at the same time, was doing this absurd local radio show where he goofed around and made fun of that kind of stuff. And so after 10 years, he suddenly burst into national prominence with both the radio show and Highly Questionable, in part because he was doing the opposite. People had 10 years to get used to two guys talking about sports topics very seriously and straightforwardly, and then suddenly Levitard can come along and make fun of it. And instead of saying, all right, J.R. Smith threw a bowl of soup at Damon Jones, how does that affect the Cavs' playoff chances? Is he going to get suspended? How will LeBron react? Does this make LeBron more or less likely to leave Cleveland? Levitard says, what was Damon Jones wearing? I hope it was a white suit.
And what kind of soup was it?
And what kind of soup would be best
to throw at somebody?
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
I'm wondering if after going to hang out with him in Miami, if what you saw has changed your view of how you would approach putting together, whether it's like a writer's room or any kind of like, you know, creative environment at your shows. Like, I would imagine that if somebody went to like see people like working on The Good Place, like people would be having a good time and enjoying each other's company. So I'm just wondering, like, what was different? Or was there anything that like, you're like, wow, like I can't believe they do things this way.
As a writer and a producer, I found the most interesting aspect of it, and I don't think this would necessarily translate in a piece for the public, but the most interesting aspect of it to me was the production of the show. Now, I would imagine that every successful radio show has a very highly skilled production team, and I don't think that this production team is unique in the world. But I would say that they are incredibly good at what they do. There is extreme value, obviously, in the amount of time that they've been doing this. Mike Ryan, who's the executive producer, has worked there since he was 19 in some form or another. Roy Bellamy's worked there for 12 years, I think. You know, Chris Cody, who's Greg Cody's son, works at the show and is like, he's the newbie, and I think he's been there for 5 years. And Billy Gill, who has been there for 9 or 10. So like, this is a group of people. They're all youngish and they've all been doing this together for a really long time. And in that clip you heard, when, after Stu Gatz reads the quote the second time, this was unexpected. This story broke while they were on the air. And after Stu Gatz read the clip the second time that, J.R. Smith had thrown a bowl of soup at Damon Jones, before Levitard says, can we get Windhorst on the phone? Mike Ryan has signaled to Allison Turner, who's the show booker, and said, get Windhorst on the phone. He just knew that this was what the show was about now. This was what was going to happen today. And they were already in the production room. They were already anticipating how Levitard was going to approach this.
And it also is an affirmation that you cannot build these kinds of shows in a laboratory. I mean, ESPN is on, what, the ninth iteration of Cold Pizza now? I mean, there's a, you know, focus grouping television shows or radio shows by these giant networks, which is what giant networks, as you well know, often aim to do. is not a guarantor of success.
Yes, you're right. And there's also, you know, there's what's the old phrase? It's like moss grows best in the dark or whatever. Like if you try to force something, if you spend a ton of money and you get all these high profile people and you say like, this guy's Q rating is this and this woman's Q rating is this and we're going to follow this particular formula, blah, blah, blah. Your chances for success are the same as it's a coin flip, right? But sometimes you have these situations where I really believe that the actual physical distance from ESPN is a big factor in how this show evolved, how it developed, and why it's successful. It's because there was no one looking over their shoulders. The stakes were low at the beginning. No one really expected them to succeed. They were just doing a local show, and they just had time to kind of work it out and kind of get their own rhythms down and figure out what the vibe was. You know, I go into this a little bit in the piece, but at the beginning, when they were first starting, Stu Gotz was actually the sort of main host of the show, and Lebatard was the like sidekick, and that didn't work. They're friends with this guy, with Boog Shambi, John Shambi, who was also a local Miami guy, and he was sort of their guru, and he said, why don't you try flipping it? Try Lebatard driving the car, try Stu Gotz in the passenger seat. They were just allowed to fail.
Last question from me is, you know, what we've described and what you described in the piece, you would think it would be a recipe for having a small kind of cult audience. But the fascinating thing is that the ratings for the show, like in this world, in the world of sports radio, are like super high. It's not like there's just like a tiny number of people, like weirdos like you, who are like devotees of what Lebatard is doing. And so, again, I'm like curious if you can analogize to your world, like how do you balance catering to the super fans and the people that listen every day with, you know, people who might be more kind of passively interested, or you want to like keep them, you know, from switching the channel if they happen to tune in, because, you know, that you've got to have both in order to have a successful program.
Right. And if I can jump in there, Mike, networks are notorious for forcing shows to tinker with their formula because they think it'll goose the audience, whether it's NPR or NBC or ESPN. And that's a risk for a show. So how does Lebatard avoid some of that and at the same time manage to do what Josh was just talking about, have big and increasing numbers?
Yeah, they've talked about this both to me and on the air. They don't particularly like it. If you've listened to the show in the last 3 or 4 months when there's been a real explosion, they busted into San Diego. They took over for Jim Rome. They bumped Jim Rome off the station in San Diego. They got into Chicago, I think, or some other big market recently. As the show has expanded, they talk a lot on the air about how the show is expanding, and they also explain a bunch of their jokes. They say they'll say things like if you're new to this show, here's what we're doing, here's why we're doing it, we have this thing. They'll explain the hard network out thing with Greg Cody, or they'll explain the you know, whatever, some dumb bit they do. And Lebatard talked to me, and he also sometimes talks to me about how it's annoying. He doesn't want to be explaining the jokes that they've been doing on this show for a decade or longer, but he also recognizes he's in this very odd space right now where his little tiny bespoke radio show from Miami, which is all he ever really wanted to do, has now exploded nationally. And he's walking this line between wanting to do the exact same show and also understanding that he has a little bit of a responsibility to at least give people the chance to get in on it. You know, like I think he feels like if he doesn't explain 5% of what the show is doing, that people will just be like, what the hell is this? And just tune out. So they don't like it, but they do it a little bit, I think, out of just a sense of sort of, you know, they recognize how incredible this is. I think that they're figuring it, like most things, they are figuring out in real time, live on the air, how it is they're supposed to handle any of this, because it really is as much a surprise to them as it is to anybody else.
Mike Schur is the creator of Parks and Rec and The Good Place, and he's a fan of Dan Lebatard. You can read his piece on The Dan Lebatard Show with Stu Gotz on Slate. We'll put it in our show page. Mike, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for letting me write the piece and for having me on the podcast.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now it is time for After Balls. And Dan Le Batard has a phrase that he uses to describe his show that I find to be extremely charming and evocative. And that is the marching band to nowhere. The example that Mike uses in his piece is that they wanted to do this big ceremony to celebrate the University of Central Florida because they were undefeated, being the real national champions of college football. And they created this elaborate like trophy and this plan for it. And then they just never did it. And so when he went to see the show, the trophy is just like sitting on the off floor, somewhere, yeah, not being used for any purpose. And thus the marching band to nowhere. A lot of march, no particular direction, but it's a fun band. Stefan, what is your marching band to nowhere?
Shohei Ohtani of the Los Angeles Angels is scheduled to pitch at home on Tuesday night against the Boston Red Sox and then maybe DH against them on Thursday. Someone no doubt will and should note that the last person to pitch and bat regularly at a super high level was also a Red Sox. They've already pointed it out, Babe Ruth, which got me wondering, Josh, if Ohtani's comparable is the Babe, did Babe have a comparable? And how did the media cover Ruth's two-way talents? To answer the first question, Ruth didn't really have a comparable. He was sui generis. His first three full seasons with Boston, Ruth was a full-time pitcher who also pinch hit occasionally. Babe Ruth convinces Slim Ray Caldwell that he is not the only home run pitcher in the game. The Boston Daily Globe wrote in 1915, that was Ruth's rookie season, Slim Ray Caldwell, best known, Josh, for drinking and getting hit by a bolt of lightning on the mound in 1919 and rising to record the final out of the game. Little aside there.
Those players back then were more dedicated.
They were tough.
Than the layabouts of our day.
Tough. In 1917, Grantland Rice noted that Caldwell was the Yankees' main pinch hitter and that Walter Johnson did the same thing for the Nationals. But the premier bird of them is Babe Ruth of the Red Sox. Ruth is probably the best hitting pitcher that baseball has ever known. He is not only a consistent batsman, but he is as likely to crack one over the fence or up into the stands as any man in baseball. Even on a bad day, Ruth was a spectacle. Chalk another for Babe Ruth, the Globe headlined. Loose as ashes on the mound, but some hitter, yes. Washington rattles in and out, just like shuttlecock. That was the headline. I don't know. I don't know exactly what happened in that game, but something happened. While Ruth was racking up wins, there was no first take debate about whether he should also be a full-time hitter. But then the Red Sox brass realized that fans showed up when Ruth played. In the 120-game war-shortened 1918 season, Ruth started 19 games on the mound and 70 more at first base or in the outfield. Before that, it was exclusively pinch hitting. Interesting nugget here. Ohtani related. The Globe reported that the Husky Baltimorean didn't play the field on the day before he was scheduled to start. That's when writers noticed the Ruthian dilemma. Ed Barrow's chief problem is where to play Babe Ruth, who wants to cavort in left field while manager would have him pitch, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch wrote in the spring of 1919. Barrow was the Red Sox manager. He was no modern thinker. The St. Louis paper wrote that Barrow has reached the conclusion that Ruth must be a left-handed pitcher most of the time and that playing him in left field in between times as a steady diet is all wrong. Ruth put an end to this conversation. He basically threw Barrow under the bus and said he wanted to play every day. Ty Cobb and Tris Speaker play every day, don't they? He told the Hartford Courant. And he clearly got his way. Ruth didn't pitch until May of 1919, and he wound up starting just 15 games for the Red Sox on the mound compared to 121 in the field, and he hit a record 29 home runs that season. So what happened? Some clues emerged after Red Sox owner Harry Frazee sold Ruth to the Yankees in January of 1920. Frazee trashed Ruth on his way out of town, calling him selfish and insubordinate. In its story about the deal, the New York Tribune reported that there is no better pitcher anywhere than Babe Ruth. But the previous season, Ruth, quote, wanted to be in the lineup every day and used every known subterfuge to gain his end, working the sore arm gag until the middle of summer. Basically, Babe Ruth kept lying and saying he was hurt when he wasn't. Ed Barrow, a couple of weeks later, admitted that Ruth pitched only under protest and that he did not put out his heart in his box work. Box was the mound. And then the Yankees announced that Ruth was done as a pitcher. Manager Miller Huggins' thought process was articulated in a story in the Los Angeles Times. Huggins, knowing baseball as few of the modern school do, has become convinced through long years of observation that no athlete can divide his time between the box and the outfield and do justice to either position. Of course, a pitcher may shuttle back and forth between the box and the outer garden for a limited period and get away with it, but eventually he will lose his stuff as a pitcher. Sounds to me like a warning from the grave from Miller Huggins to Shohei Ohtani, Josh. Only time will tell. Josh, what's your marching band to nowhere?
So last week, my friend Dan Ingber shared an article from Popular Science in 1917 on Twitter, sticking to the same era.
Era, got to stick to the Babe Ruth era.
The headline was Ice Tennis, the New Indoor Winter Sport. This one-page story included such claims as it takes both skill in skating and skill in tennis to make this new game interesting. The players serve, drive, and volley with much of the same energy and dash, which they display on ground or cement courts, skates hindering them only now and then when occasional falls occur. The court on which the men play, got to be men, is marked out with painted black lines. The regulation tennis ball is used. At first, a squash tennis ball was tried, but it proved to be too fast, even though its corded surface took a better grip on the ice than the lawn tennis ball covering. So I looked a little bit more into this. What is the deal with ice tennis? And I discovered that basically every few years, the media of the late 19th century and early 20th century would discover the exciting new game of ice tennis. Mm-hmm. The first example I found was from 1895 from a publication called Harper's Young People. And Harper's Young People said, if you try this ice tennis, you will find a great deal of amusement to be gotten out of it. And that so far as exercise is concerned, there's almost nothing in ice work that brings into play so many muscles. And besides this, it has the added recommendation of being a game which gives your mind as well as your body exercise. 1902. A newspaper noted that society in Canada is about to take up a new winter game. It is known as ice tennis. The Canadians have found that the chief trouble likely to stand in the way of ice tennis is the difficulty of getting a sufficient number of young men who are both good skaters and tennis players. Seems like an issue. The big champion in the press of ice tennis was the New York Times. This was on Christmas Eve, 1916. Skating has all aspects of boom. Indoor ice rinks have been added and outdoor ponds only await cold weather. Ice tennis is in favor! Exclamation point.
I want to point out that the Christmas Eve paper, notoriously thin.
Ice tennis is in favor. Tennis on skates recently got a trial at the Ice Palace. It required too much skating and not enough tennis, told a singles competition. But doubles, played with well-worn tennis balls, is guaranteed to furnish fine sport and exercise for all that indulge in it. Ice tennis is here to stay. It's going to find a permanent place among the winter sports. All right, let's go a few decades later. We got a 1938 newsreel from our friends at Pathé.
This ice is really meant for skating. An ex-world champion, Cecilia College, is practicing for the British Amateur Figure Skating Championships at Wembley. And the other stars are here too, including 5-year-old Nikolai Grinstein from Latvia. But figure skating is tiring, so they decide to play the game. And we believe this is the first time tennis has been played on the ice.
Two comments here, Stefan. First of all, supports my thesis that ice tennis gets discovered every few years. First time anyone's ever played ice tennis. Also, I just love the specificity. We've got to name the 5-year-old Latvian because the newsreel audience needs to know. So the reason, here's just a personal theory I've developed in the 30 minutes that I've been researching ice tennis. The reason that it keeps getting rediscovered every few years is that people stop playing it because it's terrible. And then somebody's like, oh, playing tennis on ice, that seems like a good idea. Let's give that a try. But I want to give credit to Brooklyn Life, that publication, January 20th on 1912. No byline, but the unnamed writer says this about ice tennis on skates. The fact that four girls, socially prominent, as they invariably are when they do anything like this, play tennis on the ice, wearing skates, was hailed by the press last week as a startling innovation. Nothing to it. It is all foolishness. Ice is a poor surface to play from at best, for as maybe imagined, the ball shoots and has very little rise when traveling at any speed. But if one is to play the game on ice, why wear skates when steel spikes or creepers or even rubber overshoes would be preferable? A first-rate skater but poor tennis player has all the advantage over a first-rate player but poor skater in playing on skates, but one is required to jump about with steel blades on one's feet, not to skate, and as may be imagined, this jumping about does not tend to improve the playing surface, which rapidly comes to resemble a frappéd crème de menthe.
It's green?
Look, not everything about the Brooklyn Life writer is perfect, but they're right on about tennis on ice. And when I was looking up just like references to it, there are like recent videos for, various outlets that are like, look, for the first time, we're playing tennis on ice. Isn't this fun? No, it is not fun. Do not play tennis on ice. Do not create a video for your website or publication saying you've discovered the exciting new game of tennis on ice. You haven't discovered it. And there's a reason that it doesn't exist.
I have a couple questions. Isn't the main problem with tennis on ice not that it's tennis and not that it's ice? It's the ball. You got to come up with a better ball. If the problem is that the ball skitters hither and yon.
Yeah, you're rediscovering what Brooklyn Life found out in 1912, Stefan.
No, but now we have my point.
We have the technology. Right. Well, look, just more information doesn't make us better at drafting NFL quarterbacks. It might just be an intractable problem.
It could, but I think someone owes it to all of us.
Did you have another question?
To find out. My other question is that I've noticed that you and I, when we do these deep dives into newspapers.com and ProQuest, we have a voice that we use when we read the quotations from newspapers from earlier parts of the century. And I'm curious what the cutoff is when we stop using our newsreel voice to read those quotations and when we sort of talk more normally.
I would say World War II.
Yeah, I think World War II also. I think after the war, though, post-war, maybe 1950, Korea.
That is our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup and you can email us at hangup@slate.com. For Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zalmo Beatty. And thanks for listening.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.